Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program, brought to you from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto. My name is Stephen Salm, and it is my distinct pleasure to introduce Ray Kurzweil, author of How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed. As one of the leading inventors of our time, Ray Kurzweil was the principal inventor of the first CCD flatbed scanner, the first Omnifont optical character recognition, the first print-to-speech reading machine for the blind, the first text-to-speech synthesizer, the first music synthesizer capable of recreating the grand piano and other orchestral instruments, and the first commercially marketed large vocabulary speech recognition. Among Ray Kurzweil's many honors, he is the recipient of the $500,000 MIT Lemelson Prize, the world's largest award for innovation. In 1999, he was presented the National Medal of Technology, our nation's highest honor in technology, by President Clinton. And in 2002, he was inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame, established by the U.S. Patent Office. Ray Kurzweil has written four national best-selling books, including The Singularity Is Near, a New York Times bestseller that has been the number one book on Amazon in both science and philosophy. At last count, he's received 19 honorary doctorates and honors from three U.S. presidents. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Ray Kurzweil.
Well, thank you for that warm introduction, and thanks for your kind words, Steve. It's an honor to be here and follow in, I guess, 100 years of distinguished speakers by the Commonwealth Club. And I'd like to share with you my view on the transforming impact of information technology, which is encompassing more and more things that we care about. Recently, health and medicine is becoming information technology, and our understanding of the brain is also becoming amenable to information processes, particularly now that we can actually see inside the brain. And it's another example of the exponential growth of information technology. Spatial resolution of brain scanning is doubling every year. The amount of data we're gathering is doubling every year. The precision and scale of simulations of brain regions is doubling every year. Another example of the exponential growth of information technology. And that's one of the key themes that I've actually been talking about for 30 years. And I want to touch on that for a few minutes, because exponential growth is actually not intuitive. Our intuition about the future is that it progresses in a linear manner, not an exponential manner. You might wonder, why do I have a brain? Well, we have a brain in order to predict the future. I mean, that's why the brain developed, so I can anticipate the consequences of my actions or inaction. So 1,000 years ago, I saw an animal walking towards a rock, and I saw myself walking on a different path towards the same rock, and I could actually estimate, we're going to arrive there at the same time. I'm going to go a different way. That turned out to be useful for survival. That became hardwired in our brains. We made a prediction where the animal would be, and it was a linear prediction, and it worked very well for predicting the future course of an animal in the wild. It's not satisfactory when it comes to predicting information technology, but people still use our linear intuition. And that's actually the principal difference between my critics and myself. They look at the current situation, the same one I'm looking at, and then apply their linear intuition. So, for example, halfway through the Genome Project, 7.5 years into a 15-year project, we had finished 1% of the project. So mainstream skeptics were going strong. So, okay, 7.5 years, 1%. It's going to take 750 years, just like we said. That's linear thinking. My reaction was, no, we're almost done. I mean, once you get to 1% on an exponential progression, you're just about finished. I mean, it's only 7 doublings from 100%. It had been doubling every year. And indeed, that's exactly what happened. It continued to double every year. It was finished 7 years later. That has continued past to the end of the Genome Project. The first genome was $1 billion. Now it's down to 10,000. It'll be at $1,000 soon. NIH is collecting 1 million genomes. That's just one example of the exponential progression of information technology and how surprising it is. I saw the ARPANET doubling every year, but there's only a few thousand scientists, and I predicted a World Wide Web connecting hundreds of millions of people to each other and to vast knowledge resources emerging by the late 90s, and people thought that was ridiculous when the entire American defense budget could only tie together 2,000 scientists. But that is what happened, and that's the power of exponential growth, and there's many other examples of that. And it's not just computers. It's gradually encompassing more and more fields are succumbing to becoming information technologies. And you might well, really, how different is linear versus exponential growth? Well, if I take 30 steps linearly, that's our intuition, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I get to 30. If I take 30 steps exponentially, that's the reality of not everything, but of information technology, price, performance, capacity, scale, 2, 4, 8, 16, at step 30, I'm at 1 billion. It makes a huge difference. And this is not an idle conjecture about the future. I mean, this is several billion times more powerful than the computer I used as a student. It's 1 million times cheaper, it's several thousand times more powerful in terms of computation speed, memory, communication ability, and that's not even including the cloud, which is where the really interesting things take place. It's 100,000 times smaller. We're going to do both of those things again in another 25 years. It gives you some idea of what will be feasible. And so I began to examine this in 1981, but the story actually goes back even further to when I was 5. I decided I wanted to be an inventor. I had all these enrichment toys that my parents gave me that had lots of little parts sent to them, erector sets and other toys, which I would take apart, and I'd amassed this inventory of little pieces, and I went through the neighborhood and I gathered radios and broken down bicycles and took them apart. This was an era where you would allow a 5-year-old to go through the neighborhood and come back with old equipment. And I had this idea, if I could put these things together in just the right way, I could create transcendent effects. I did not have that vocabulary. I came up with that word a few years ago. But I remember the magical feeling I had about the power of ideas. I mean, I had here the solution to the world's problems. I just had to figure out the right way to put these things together. And it took me a while to do that. But I became enamored with being an inventor. Other kids were wondering what they wanted to be, a nurse, a fireman. I always had this conceit, I know what I'm going to be. But I realized about 1981, about 30 years ago, that the key to being successful as an inventor was timing. And the inventors we remember were in exactly the right place at the right time. Near here, Larry Page and Sergey Brin had a great idea about reverse engineering the links on the internet to create a better search engine, but they did it at exactly the right time. And you remember the names of the people who did that. There were dozens of other promising search engine projects, but they weren't really in the right place at the right time with the right idea. And so realizing this, timing actually turns out to be important for just about everything from investing to romance. You gotta be in the right place, the right time, with the right idea. And I realized that the world would actually be a very different place by the time I finished the project. If a project takes a few years, the world will be different. That's even more true now than it was in 1981. By the way, acceleration is another one of these progressions that's exponential. Our first invention, spoken language, took hundreds of thousands of years. And then people realized that these stories are drifting, changing every time people retell them. And so we invented written language. That only took tens of thousands of years. Then we needed a more efficient way of creating written language. So the printing press was developed, and that took about 400 years to reach a mass audience. I gave a speech at the University of Basel on the occasion of its 550th anniversary, which is right after Gutenberg made his invention, 20 years later, and right in the same spot. And I said, wow, you must have had some of his books when you opened your doors 550 years ago. And they said, yes, we got them very quickly. It was only a century later. I mean, that is how ideas spread in those days, slowly. The telephone took only 50 years to reach a quarter of the U.S. population. The cell phone took 7 years. Social networks, wikis, and blogs took 3 years. I mean, just think how fundamental a part of our lives things like Wikipedia and Facebook and a lot of other paradigms like that people didn't use 3 or 4 years ago. I mean, it sounds like ancient history to not have those resources. 10 years ago, most people didn't use search engines. That really sounds like ancient history. It wasn't so long ago. So I wondered, you know, what can we anticipate about the future? And I started out with the common wisdom that you cannot predict the future. And it turns out that's true for specific projects, specific companies, specific standards. But if you ask me what will be the cost in today's dollars of a MIP of computing in 3 years or 10 years, or how many bits will be moving around the world wirelessly today, 5 years, 10 years from now, I can give you a figure that will be very accurate. In fact, 30 years ago, I began to plot these things, and I'll show you some of these graphs, and notice this fantastically smooth progression, and then actually continued these curves to 2050, and we're now 2012, and we're exactly where we should be, for a whole variety of information technologies. It's amazingly predictable. And what's predictable is that they grow exponentially. So I'd like to examine this a little more and make the connection to the brain, which, as I mentioned, our brains are not growing exponentially yet, but when we are able to enhance them by merging with non-biological technology, they will. But our understanding of the brain is progressing in an exponential manner. So these are some of the ideas I wanted to share with you. Any questions on any of this? I'll try to go a little more slowly. But a very predictable exponential trend is the shrinking of technology, not just electronics, but mechanical technology as well, with things like MEMS, microelectronic mechanical systems. We're shrinking technology at a rate in terms of the feature size of 100 per decade in three-dimensional feature size. And here's that graph I had. This was the first one I had, of the power of computers for the same cost. So this is calculations per second per constant dollar. This is in 2009 dollars. And I had this actually only through 1981. And people go, oh, Moore's Law. But actually, Moore's Law was only underway for about 10 years at that time. It has to do with chips, the fact that you can put twice as many transistors on a chip every 2 years and they run faster. But that was actually not the first paradigm to bring exponential growth to computing. This started decades before Gordon Moore was even born. It goes back to the 1890 census. The 1950s, the third paradigm was vacuum tubes. CBS predicted the election of Eisenhower with a vacuum tube-based computer, the first time the networks did that. Remember that? I said that at Yelp this morning, and they're all like 20 years old. So they've heard of Eisenhower. But they kept shrinking the size of vacuum tubes, and finally they couldn't shrink them anymore and keep the vacuum, and that was the end of the shrinking of vacuum tubes. So it was not the end of the exponential growth of computing price performance. It just went to the fourth paradigm and then the fifth paradigm. And people have been saying, oh, Moore's Law is going to come to an end. Gordon Moore originally said 2002. Intel now says 2022. Key feature size will be 4 nanometers, which is the size of 20 carbon atoms at that time. And we won't be able to shrink them anymore, but we'll just go to the 6th paradigm, which is computing in 3 dimensions, not 2. Chips are flat. We're already taking baby steps in that many chips today are actually multi-layer. 30% of all memory chips are 3-dimensional. That'll keep this going for a very long time. This is a logarithmic scale. Every level on this graph is 100,000 times greater than the level below it. It's not a linear scale. So a straight line represents exponential growth, and this is actually super exponential. So we're actually increasing the rate of exponential growth exponentially. This represents trillions-fold increase in the amount of computation you can buy per constant dollar over the last century, several billion-fold just since I was a student. But the most interesting thing is look at how smooth a progression that is. I mean, where's World War I or World War II? People say, well, it must have slowed down during the Great Depression. No, it didn't. Or it must have sped up during war because war is the father of invention. But that didn't happen either. Must have slowed down during the recent recession. That didn't happen. This goes through thick and thin, through war and peace, through boom times and recessions and the Great Depression. It has a mind of its own. The reason for this is we're always building the latest technology using today's technology. So we are creating the computers of 2013, 2014 with the computers of 2012. We didn't have those computers in 2002. We had the computers of 2002, so we were creating the computers of 2004. And that's why it progresses in this exponential manner. I have a whole mathematical treatment of this, and singularity is near. But really, the empirical evidence is the most convincing. This is a curve I put in place in 1981, and it's continued to be highly predictive. In the 50s and early 60s, I hung out at the Surplus Electronics Shops on Canal Street in New York. If you're ever in downtown New York, you might check them out. They're still there. And I'd buy something about this big for $50. I could switch one bit of information. It was a telephone relay with support circuitry. It cost $50, and it was pretty slow. I was excited. In 1968, I could buy a transistor that was smaller and faster for only $1 that did the same thing. You can now buy several billion for a dollar. But again, look at how smooth a progression that is. And as they're smaller, they're faster. So the cost of a transistor cycle, which is a measure of price performance, comes down by half every year. So that's why you can buy an iPhone that's twice as good as the one 2 years ago for half the price. That's a 4-fold increase in price performance, a 50% deflation rate. We put half of that improved price performance in lower prices. We put half of it into better performance, so you get better products for less cost. And it's not just because Apple is so clever. That's the law of accelerating returns. And economists actually worry about deflation. We had massive deflation during the Depression. And the concern is if you can get the same stuff, same capabilities you could last year for half the price, the same computing, the same communications, the same genetic sequencing, even physical things, as I'll show you with 3-dimensional printing, we can turn information files into a whole range of physical things that are also expanding. You will buy more. I mean, that's economics 101. But you're not going to double your consumption because, after all, how much do you need? And you can't really double your need for these things year after year to keep up with this 50% deflation rate. So therefore, the size of the economy, not as measured in bits and bytes and base pairs, but as measured in currency, will shrink. And for a variety of good reasons, that would actually not be a good thing. And that's actually not what happens. We actually more than double our consumption. I've got 50 charts like this. This is bits of memory purchased, but I can show you bits of communication purchased and lots of other measures, the amount of genetic sequencing. We do, it's more than doubles because of the reduced price. There's actually been 18% growth in constant dollars every year of every form of information technology for the last 50 years, despite the fact that you can get twice as much of it each year for the same price. And the reason for that is as price performance reaches certain levels, whole new applications explode. I mean, why did social networks start exploding approximately 3 years ago? Is it just because Mark Zuckerberg didn't show up before that? No, it's because it was the price performance couldn't support it economically in terms of communication and computation and memory costs. Prior to that, it was too expensive to even... There were some predecessors to Facebook, but they were arguing whether they could afford to allow you to put a picture on the site. And so, you know, until the price performance really makes it worthwhile, these things don't take off. This is actually what's driving economic growth. It's the non-information technology industries that are shrinking in size. Time magazine ran a cover story on my law of accelerating returns. They wanted to put a particular computer on the graph that they had covered in the magazine. And I said, well, you know, it could be below the graph. It's never going to be above the graph, but sometimes people, this was just introduced. Maybe it's not cost effective. It won't last in the marketplace, but it turns out it's right on the graph. It's the last point there. And this is a curve that I laid out 30 years ago. It's been remarkably predictive. That's the number of bits we move around wirelessly in the world. So it's over the last century. So 100 years ago, that was Morse code over AM radio. Now it's 4G networks. Again, that's trillions-fold increase. It's a logarithmic scale. Every level there is 1,000 times greater than the level below it. But look at how smooth a progression that is. Despite all the vagaries of announcements of telecommunications company goes bankrupt, new auctions of spectrum space, despite all that unpredictable history, we get these very predictable trajectories. Internet data traffic growing very smoothly, roughly doubling every year. This is that graph I had of the Internet. It's called the ARPANET. I had these first few points and projected out a World Wide Web connecting hundreds of millions of people by the late 90s, and people thought that was ridiculous. But that is what happened. And this is the same data but seen on a linear scale. And that's how we actually experience it. We don't experience it on a log scale. So to the casual observer, it looked like, whoa, the World Wide Web's a new thing, came out of nowhere. But you could see it coming from its predecessors. Because once it reaches a certain critical point, it kind of reaches the knee of the curve as seen on a linear scale, and suddenly it's visible. Genetic sequencing was just the beginning of a major revolution in health and medicine to make that an information technology. And health and medicine was not an information technology before. It was just hit or miss. We'd find something. Oh, here's something that lowers blood pressure. Here's something that kills the HIV virus. So we would look for these things. Drug development was called drug discovery, maybe going through systematically 10,000 compounds and testing each one to see which one did something without really a model of how it worked or why it should work. Now we're actually understanding biology as a software process, which is fundamentally what it is. We have 23,000 genes, which are basically little software programs. They're not written in C++. I think they're written in COBOL. Oh, good. We got some technical people in the audience. And some technical people who remember COBOL. They're actually written in three-dimensional protein interactions, but they're linear sequences of data. And they evolved thousands of years ago when, for example, it was not in the interest of the human species for people to live past early 20s. By that time, you'd raised your kid to be old enough, like 12, and you're just using up the precious resources of the tribe. One of the software programs I have running in my body is called the fat insulin receptor gene. It basically says, hold on to every calorie because the next hunting season may not work out so well. And that was a great idea 1,000 years ago. We spent all day trying to get a few calories. And there were no refrigerators, so we stored them in the fat cells of our body. And I would like to tell my fat insulin receptor gene, you don't need to do that anymore. I'm confident the next hunting season will be good at the supermarket. That was actually tried near where I work in Boston at the Joslin Diabetes Center. These animals ate ravenously and remained slim and didn't get diabetes and get heart disease. They lived 20% longer. They got the health benefits of caloric restriction. While doing the opposite, they're working with a drug company to bring that to the human market. That's just one of the 23,000 genes we'd like to tinker with. There are hundreds of projects like that to turn off genes that encourage or permit disease processes like cancer and heart disease to progress. Conversely, there are hundreds of projects to add genes that will protect us from disease or prevent a disease. I'm working with a company where we take lung cells out of the body of patients that have a disease caused by a missing gene. So if you're missing this one gene, you're likely to get pulmonary hypertension. It's a terminal disease. And it's just caused by not having this gene. So we take the lung cells, scrape them out of the throat. In vitro, we add the gene using new gene therapy techniques. It doesn't trigger the immune system because it takes place outside the body. We inspect it got done correctly. We replicate that cell several million fold. It's another new technology injected back into the body, goes through the bloodstream. The body recognizes them as lung cells. And this has actually cured this disease in human trials, and it's continuing to be tested. And there are hundreds of other projects like this. Another example is my father had a heart attack in 61, and it damaged his heart, so he could hardly walk. It's called low ejection fraction or heart failure, and he finally died of it in 1970. There was nothing you could do about it then. There was nothing you could do about it like 5 years ago. But now we can actually reprogram stem cells to rejuvenate the heart. And this is a therapy used in clinical practice. It's right on the edge. It's not yet approved here in the United States. It probably will be soon. You have to do medical tourism to get it, but I've talked to people who could hardly walk and now have a normal heart. 50% of all heart attack survivors have this problem of some damage to their heart. There's many other examples, but they're all examples where we're basically reprogramming the software of biology. And one reason that's significant, it's not just a new approach to treating disease, it's now making health and medicine an information technology, and it's therefore subject to this law of accelerating returns. These technologies, which are already beginning to get traction, will be 1,000 times more powerful in 10 years, 1,000,000 times more powerful in 20 years, and it will be a very different era. If I want to send you a movie or a book or a music album, 3 years ago I would have sent you a FedEx package. Now I can send you an email attachment. I can also send you this violin or this guitar if you have the requisite three-dimensional printer and you can print them out. And this is a revolution right before the storm. It's social networks, you know, 8 or 9 years ago before they really took off. The precision, the scale of the precision is getting better, improving very dramatically. It's still above 1 micron. It needs to go submicron. The costs were hundreds of thousands of dollars and tens, then thousands. Now it's thousands. Needs to go sub-$1,000. We'll be there in a few years. The range of materials is getting very extensive. This metal ring here was actually printed out on a three-dimensional printer. You can today print out 70% of the parts you need using your three-dimensional printer to create another three-dimensional printer. That will be 100% within 5 to 8 years. So this is going to dramatically change manufacturing. A very wide range of products we'll be able to manufacture. Go out to the 2020s, since, you know, multi-nanometer feature sizes will be feasible. We'll be able to print out things like clothing. And there'll be a very vibrant open source availability of these designs. But that won't kill the proprietary forms, just like the situation we have today. I mean, you can have a very good time listening to open source, that is to say free music, reading free books, looking at free videos and free full-length movies, but people still spend money to see the latest blockbuster, to read Harry Potter or whatever, and those industries are doing okay to create proprietary forms of this information. But this is another revolution that's coming. So that brings me to the brain. I've been thinking about thinking for 50 years, and I wrote a paper 50 years ago when I was 14. It was my submission to the Westinghouse Science Talent Search, which is now the Intel Science Talent Search, that the brain was really one big pattern recognizer, and it was capable of recognizing lots of different patterns in parallel. And I wrote a program that could analyze those patterns in music. So if I fed in Chopin, it would then write original music using the same patterns it discovered in Chopin's music. And it would be original music, but it would sound like a student of Chopin's. And I got to meet President Johnson and took it on a TV show, I've Got a Secret. And this is articulating the same idea, but updated by 50 years of neuroscience and my own thought experiments, which I take the reader through, and work in artificial intelligence, which doesn't absolutely tell us how the brain works, but it tells us which methods might work by showing existence proof that certain techniques work. And it was, in fact, 50 years ago that a neuroscientist, Vernon Mountcastle, noticed that the neocortex, which is the part of the brain where we do our thinking, particularly our hierarchical thinking, was completely uniform. All of it looked the same. The connection patterns looked the same. That's all he noticed. Then neuroscience went in the direction of talking about specialization and noticing that if a particular region is actually damaged in a stroke or an accident, that suddenly people will learn to lose certain skills, and so they assign certain skills to certain areas. And the assumption was that these different regions must work differently. There's a little region called the fusiform gyrus that recognizes faces. So they must have some specialized circuitry that's organized for faces. And V1, where the optic nerve spills into, recognizes edges of objects and very simple shapes, and that must be optimized for that. And of course, the frontal cortex, we do these high-level concepts and language and so on, that must be optimized for that. But it turns out, and a lot of the best research on this just came out as I was sending the book off to the publisher, and I actually held it up to include some of this latest research, which the publisher wasn't happy about, and we actually delayed the publication date. And they said, this can look like the book's in trouble. And I said, well, we got to get it right. One of those research studies was what happens to V1, which does these low-level visual image recognition, in a congenitally blind person. They're not getting any visual images. Does it sit there and do nothing? It actually gets harnessed by the frontal cortex to help it with high-level language concepts. And so suddenly it's doing high-level language concepts, which shows that the algorithm is the same. But what is the difference? The difference is its position in a hierarchy. And where does that hierarchy come from? Well, that actually comes from our own experience. We actually build that hierarchy. The fundamental unit is an actual module of approximately 100 neurons. It's repeated 300 million times. So we have 300 million of these modules that can recognize a pattern. And so the fundamental module is not a neuron. So this whole field of neural nets is based on that an individual neuron is a unit. And an individual neuron doesn't actually do enough, and I've never been a fan of that methodology, and it doesn't actually work that well. But this module of 100 neurons can do a lot more. It can actually, in a sophisticated manner, recognize a pattern, even if parts of the pattern aren't there. And it can wire itself to a higher level of concept based on the experiences we have. So our ability to understand this has been growing exponentially. I mean, here's the different types of brain scanning, all of which, the resolution of which has improved in an exponential manner. But let me show you a very simplified example of what I'm talking about. So I have, in my 300 million panel recognizes, a number that are very good at recognizing the crossbar and a capital A. That's all it cares about. A pretty girl can walk by and it doesn't care. It gets really excited when it sees the crossbar and a capital A. And it goes, whoa, crossbar! And it then sends a high probability up to a higher level. And at a higher level, it's getting that input and other inputs, and it might then fire saying, aha, capital A. And it sends a signal up, and at a higher level, there's a pattern recognizer that might go, ah, the word apple. In another region of the visual cortex, there might be a pattern recognizer that fires, ah, an actual visual apple. In the auditory cortex, same organization, but it happens to be dealing with auditory information. There might be a pattern recognizer that fires, ah, someone just said the word apple. Go up a number of more levels, and now it's getting input from multiple senses, and there might be a pattern recognizer that sees a certain fabric, it smells a certain perfume, it hears a certain voice, and says, ah, my wife has entered the room. Go up at a much higher level, and there's pattern recognizers that go, oh, that was funny, that was ironic, she's pretty. You probably think that those are much more complicated. They're actually the same. They just exist at the top of this conceptual hierarchy. In the book, I described this surgery that this young girl had, and she was conscious, which you can be during brain surgery because there are no pain receptors in the brain. And whenever the surgeons triggered a particular spot in her neocortex, she would start to laugh. So they thought maybe they're triggering some kind of laugh reflex, but they quickly realized they were actually triggering the perception of humor. She just found everything hilarious whenever they triggered this spot. You guys are so funny just standing there was a typical comment. Only when they were triggering this spot, because these guys actually weren't that funny. And she obviously has more than one spot for humor, but they had found one of them. And so where does this hierarchy come from? Well, that's what we build ourselves. Another piece of research that came out just as I was saying the book off is that there are these modules throughout the neocortex of about 100 neurons, and the wiring within them and the structure within them is not plastic and doesn't change and is stable throughout life. It's the connection between these modules that changes. So each module can learn a pattern and then connect itself to other modules. And there's actually a whole connection system, and that's another piece of recent research at the Mass General Hospital, that shows a very stable wiring that's actually very uniform across the whole neocortex with axons that go vertical and axons that go horizontal, kind of like the street map of Manhattan. And so if one module wants to wire itself to another, it just picks the right two right vertical and right horizontal axon and makes the final connection. But these are sort of connections in waiting, and we're born with a vast number of them, and we actually trim out the ones that we never use over time. So we're creating these connections. So it's true you are what you eat, but it's even more true that you are what you think, because these connections reflect what ultimately is your personality, your knowledge, your skills, your memory, are all created with these connections. So be careful who you hang out with. I think hanging out with Commonwealth Club members is probably a good idea. And so the last question I would address on this is 300 million a lot or a little? And it was a lot from one perspective in that other primates, which have a similar neocortex but don't have this additional neocortex we had because we have this large forehead that allowed the frontal cortex. And that additional quantity was the enabling factor for the qualitative leap that humans made to create language and art and science and music and invention and technology. No other primate did that. Some have very primitive possible ability to do simple language or use simple tools. But the real indefinite expansion of hierarchical knowledge that humans demonstrate is because of that greater quantity of neocortex that we have. And ultimately, we will expand it more. I mean, we've expanded our brains already with these brain extenders. We can access all of human knowledge with a few keystrokes. I felt like a part of my brain went on strike during that one-day SOPA strike. We really have offloaded a lot of our personal memories and collective memory and knowledge and ability to find that to the cloud. But we're still limited by 300 million pattern recognizers. Ultimately, we will expand beyond that by thinking in the cloud, which is exactly where anything interesting computationally happens. If you do anything interesting on this, do a search or ask Siri or Google Now a question or translate from one language to another, it doesn't take place in this rectangle. This is just a gateway to the cloud. Suddenly you need 10,000 computers to find something that's available to you in the cloud, and the power of the cloud is going to itself grow exponentially. Well, we've already shown we can connect computers to the brain. There are people who have computers connected into their brain, like Parkinson's patients. The latest generation of that neural implant allows you to download new software to the neural implant inside your brain from outside the patient. The New York Times recently had an article expressing concern about people hacking into the software that people are downloading into their brains. And that's fairly primitive today compared to what we will ultimately be able to do. We'll be ultimately be able to do that non-invasively once these computers are blood cell size, and we'll be able to send them into the brain just to connect at a massively parallel fashion millions of points to the cloud and then be able to go beyond 300 million pattern recognizers. I'm actually working on creating synthetic neocortex. It's based on these principles that will be able to deal with hierarchical knowledge and actually understand language. And we have good examples of that already. For example, Watson does a very good job of understanding language. How many of you know the answer to this Jeopardy question? A long, tiresome speech delivered by a frothy pie topping. Anybody know the answer to that?
Meringue harangue.
Yeah, what is a meringue harangue? You probably saw that, or maybe
no.
You... No? No? Did you read it in my book?
Yeah.
No? Okay. Well, you might have... So it is actually an answerable question. The two human players, Jenkins and the other guy, who are the best Jeopardy players in the history of the game, were not able to answer it. And, in fact, Watson got a higher score than the best two human players put together. And what's not appreciated is Watson didn't get its knowledge by the engineers programming all these facts in Lisp or some other computer language. Watson actually read Wikipedia and several other encyclopedias, 200 million pages of documents written in natural language. And those documents are ambiguous. You know, when you read a Wikipedia article, I'm sometimes confused, well, what do they mean by this? And I have to read another article. And it's able to do all that cross-referencing and understand it well enough to actually answer these questions in 3 seconds and master it all. It has total recall. Its ability actually to understand a page is less than you or I. You might, if you didn't know anything about the presidency, you might read a page and say, there's a 97% chance that Barack Obama's president. And Watson will read it and say, there's a 62% chance that Barack Obama is president. But Watson will have read, 200,000 pages that deal with that issue and can combine all that information with very good probability theory and come out with the conclusion that there's a 99.99% chance that Barack Obama is president. So it can actually synthesize all this material. It's a very impressive, but a very good harbinger of what's coming. If you think about how useful search engines are, they're still based largely on keywords, just looking for words and strings of characters and not really understanding the concepts. There's actually a lot of information that's useful if you actually understood the concepts, which is what these pages were originally created to do. Within, I'd say, 5 years, computers are going to be able to do that routinely. I mean, that is Watson did a pretty good job of that, and that's just the first step. So that's where we're headed. But ultimately, we'll be able to actually expand our thinking into the cloud. So in the few minutes I have left, and we want to leave time for some dialogue, I want to examine a question whether or not all of these technological changes taken together are helping or hurting humanity. And being here in the Silicon Valley area, it's an area of the world which I think is pretty bullish about the ability of technology to help with human problems. But there's a strong school of thought that says the world's getting worse and that technology is responsible and things were much better off before technology interfered with our lives. And I remind people to read writers like Charles Dickens or Thomas Hobbes, who described life not so long ago, a couple of centuries ago, as short, brutish, disaster-prone, disease-filled, poverty-filled. But I have a number of these graphs, which actually take us through a trip of the last 200 years, because people forget what things were like. A lot of people weren't around in 1800. These are all countries. The big red circle is China. Keep an eye on China because it does some interesting things. We're going to see the progress of these countries on two dimensions as stand-ins for health and wealth. So wealth, this is a logarithmic scale. It's income per person in today's dollars, so you can understand it. And it was in hundreds of dollars. There's a have-have-not divide. Some countries are better off, but nobody was very rich. And typically, the average was like $500. And then life expectancy on the y-axis was in the 20s and 30s. The worldwide average was 37. So what happened? Well, a few countries in the early 19th century were experimenting with the first industrial revolution and the automation, and there began to be progress, which picked up as we got to the end of the century. But as we get to the 20th century, you'll see a wind that carries all these countries towards the upper right-hand corner of the graph. The have-have-not divide does not go away. But at the end of the process, the countries that are worst off are much better off than the countries that were best off at the beginning of the process. And I shouldn't say end of the process, because the process hasn't ended. In fact, it's going to go into even higher gear as we get to more mature phases of biotechnology, its effect on agriculture, artificial intelligence, three-dimensional printing, and so on. Education, we are destroying jobs at the bottom of the skill ladder. It's always easy to describe the jobs that are going away that started with the Luddites and the textile industry in England in 1800. If I were a prescient futurist in 1900, I would say a third of you work on farms, a third of you work in factories, but I predict that in 100 years that will be 3% and 3%. And everyone would go, oh, my God, we're all going to be out of work. And I say, well, don't worry. You'll get jobs as web designers and designing new chips and social networking sites. And 65% of the jobs today are knowledge jobs, creating some kind of intellectual property. Most of those jobs didn't exist even a few decades ago, let alone a century ago. And we can't really describe them. So the answer would be, well, there'll be new jobs, but I can't tell you what they are. And that's never very convincing. But in fact, we have a higher percentage of the population working. The new jobs pay 8 times as much in constant dollars. I mean, why didn't we have any social safety net at all before 1930? That's when Social Security was put in. Is it just because the country wasn't that liberal enough? It's because the money wasn't there. There's been continual increase in wealth. And we made continual increases in investment in education in order to provide the higher level of skills, because the new jobs are at the top of the skill ladder. So we now spend 10 times as much in constant dollars per student as compared to a century ago on K through 12. We have 12 million college students compared to 50,000 in 1870. We've tripled the amount of education that a child in the developing world receives. We doubled it in the developed world. There's a have-have-not divide, but they're both moving in the right direction. Energy, I don't really have time to get into this in detail, but Larry Page and I did a study for the National Academy of Engineering. And we looked at different emerging energy technologies, and the cost of solar energy is coming down rapidly as we're applying information technologies like nanotechnology to design of solar panels and energy storage. The total amount of solar energy produced in the world is on this exponential rise. That's a logarithmic scale. It's doubling every 2 years. So the National Academy of Engineering adopted Larry and my reports, presented it to the Prime Minister of Israel not too long ago, who was actually in my class at the Sloan School in the 1970s, and he said, "Ray, but do we have enough sunlight to do this with?" And I said, "Yes, we have 10,000 times more than we need. I mean, after we double seven more times and are meeting 100% of our energy needs, because we're right now at 1%, and people dismiss it just because, oh, it's 1%, it's kind of a fringe player, it's a nice thing to do, but it's never going to be significant, just like they dismiss the Internet or the Genome Project when it was 1%. But it's only seven doublings from 100% at 2 years each. And at that point, we'll be using one part in 10,000 of the sunlight. So this is the progress we've made before health and medicine was an information technology, when it was just hit or miss. Still pretty useful. I gave a speech to junior high school kids, 12 and 13-year-old science winners from around the world, and I said, if it hadn't been for this progress, you all would be senior citizens, because life expectancy was 20,000 years ago. It's now pushing 80, but this is going to go into high gear as we get to the more mature phases of the biotechnology revolution. According to my models, within 15 years, we'll be adding more than a year every year to your remaining life expectancy. It's kind of a tipping point. It's not a guarantee, but as you go forward, your remaining life expectancy will actually advance and move away from you. So if you can hang in there, we may get to see the remarkable century ahead. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Ray Kurzweil, for those fascinating insights. We have the chance to bring some audience questions here. And actually, one of the ones that has come up, it has to do with energy that you're talking about, with solar energy in particular. Someone expressing a little bit of skepticism, saying with solar production, with PV production, there's the labor and materials. It's not the information technology side. Can it really continue to grow exponentially, as you were talking about?
Well, I mean, that's actual data, and that is straight exponential growth. And the analyses by the industry show that that will continue. And there's very major investments being made in some places, China in particular, Germany, a fair amount in the United States. The reason that Solyndra went bankrupt is not because the demand wasn't there, but because they couldn't keep up or keep down with the rapidly declining costs of the competition. They weren't progressing technologically fast enough. So there's always going to be winners and losers. The fact is we have 10,000 times more sunlight than we need to meet 100% of our energy needs. And there's many other scenarios. Could go 1 or 2 miles this way, and this tremendous amount of heat, geothermal energy, also thousands of times more than we need. And there are other scenarios. We can even collect fossil fuel energy in a clean, renewable fashion, and we actually have plenty of that. We're now using shale oil and these kinds of, and we have actually thousands of times more energy than we need in those forms. And there are ways of doing that that are renewable. So we're only running out of energy if you limit yourself to sort of 19th century techniques.
Looking at the future with a much more positive, interesting, from a much more positive, interesting perspective, this first person in the audience wants to know, with these technological advances, influencing the way that we're going to go about making decisions, how will that change business, medicine, personal life?
Well, we can see profound changes already. Take, for example, the tools of creativity. My father was a conductor and concert pianist and a composer, and if you want to hear one of his orchestral compositions, that was a huge deal, and he'd actually tried to do that on a number of occasions and had to raise money from funders and assemble an orchestra, and the big day would come and I'd be up with him the night before running off scores on a mimeograph machine. Anybody remember a mimeograph machine? And then he would teach them the music, and finally he'd hear his composition. And he could maybe make a few changes on the fly, but if you really want to make significant reworking of the piece, he'd have to start over again. Now a kid in her dorm room can do that with her PC or synthesizer, create a whole orchestra, a jazz band, or rock group, and they do that all the time. A kid with a notebook computer created Facebook and Yelp and Google. It was a late night dorm room challenge by two graduate students near here. A kid in Africa with a smartphone has access to more creative power and access to knowledge and information than the President of the United States did 15 years ago. So these are very personally empowering technologies. They're also democratizing. Another prediction I made in the early 80s is that the Soviet Union would be swept away by the then emerging social network, this clandestine network of hackers who kept everybody in the know and destroyed the monopoly on communication that the authorities had by grabbing the central TV and radio station. There was early forms of email with teletype machines and fax machines. And people thought, yes, I mean, they're interesting, and it does, some people were getting some information that way, but this is not going to sweep away the Soviet Union, which is a mighty superpower with a few teletype machines. But that's exactly what happened in the 1991 coup against Gorbachev. And then we had a great wave of democratization in the 90s with the rise of the web, and we see the impact of social networks today. And whereas it never moves in exactly a straight line, it is deeply democratizing. Even in China, there's 200 million blogs where people are pretty freewheeling. You might not want to label your blog of the day, remember Tiananmen Square, but if you avoid certain issues, actually there's a lot of freewheeling political and social cultural discussion by individuals. It's going to revolutionize education. We're just at the beginning of what's going to be a huge wave of revolutionizing higher education, the business model of which is broken. And you now have this new business model, which is almost free, with very high quality education. And by the way, you've got the whole developing world plugging into that. There's hundreds of schools in Africa where kids gather around a computer and take an MIT or Stanford course using their open courseware systems. And so I could go on and on, but it's having a profound impact already on people's lives. And increasingly, the kinds of businesses that are successful are ones that deeply involve their users to create the content and so on.
What about the effect on being able to deal with genetic diseases, cures for genetic diseases? Because that's one of the things that you get into very much in the book is the miniaturization of computerization, so that we'll actually be injecting into the bloodstream.
Well, you mentioned actually a couple of ideas there. Being able to fix genetic diseases is very much kind of on the drawing board, and that we can actually change our genes, not just in a newborn. We'll have not just designer babies, but designer baby boomers, which I'm personally more interested in. And I gave a couple of examples in my talk of turning off the fat insulin receptor gene or adding a gene that's missing, that causes the absence of which causes pulmonary hypertension. And there are hundreds of examples of this. We can actually now create stem cell therapies are no longer controversial because we can create the equivalent of embryonic stem cells from your skin cells by reprogramming them, by adding four genes, turning them into what's called IPCs, induced pluripotent cells, which are equivalent to embryonic stem cells. and then grow a new kidney or a new liver. This company I'm involved in is actually growing new lungs. This has been successfully done in animals. It's done now for simpler organs in humans, so that's progressing. The ethicists who are opposed to embryonic stem cell research because it involved the destruction of an embryo support this because there's no embryo involved. And anyway, if you want a new kidney, you'd like to have your DNA, not the DNA of some other embryo. So there's lots of things happening as we're turning biology into an information technology. That's kind of biotechnology. Nanotechnology, and I kind of went over that, I kind of skipped that slide, but we will be putting millions of little blood cell-sized devices to keep us healthy and also to go inside our brains. And if that sounds very futuristic, there's already dozens of experiments of using nano-engineered devices for therapeutic purposes in animals. One scientist cured type 1 diabetes in rats with a blood cell-sized device that's nano-engineered, 7-nanometer pores, lets insulin out of control fashion, blocks antibodies. So there's many examples of that. If you go out to the 2030s, these can have little computers in them. One application, for example, will be to augment our immune system. Now, our immune system is great. We wouldn't last very long without it. But it's got some real limitations. It doesn't recognize cancer, for example. It thinks that's you. It doesn't work very well against most viruses. Sometimes it thinks that you are the enemy, that's autoimmune disorders. We can actually fix those problems with a blood cell-sized device that would act like a white blood cell but would actually be much more intelligent and overcome these limitations. And then ultimately they can go inside the brain and create then gateways from the neurons to the cloud, just the same way that this isn't basically a gateway to the cloud right now.
Now, one of the things that's fascinating in how to create a mind is while you're addressing all these things that seem the stuff of dreams in the future, you also come back to poetry over and over again as a touchstone in it. And you talk about the importance of poetry and the place it has in the hierarchy of the brain. I mean, you even lead with an epigraph from Emily Dickinson. So I'm wondering, what turned you on to poetry? Who got you going?
Well, I actually majored in MIT in computer science and creative writing, and my thesis was a book of poems. And poetry is kind of the ultimate expression of language. It's taking the ability of language to represent very high-level concepts and expressing them in a condensed way, an intense way that can really communicate emotion, which is, in my view, not some sideshow to human intelligence. That's the cutting edge of human intelligence. Being funny, expressing a loving sentiment, and that's what, of course, poetry is trying to do, is the cutting edge of human intelligence. If you were to say, no, that's just kind of a sideshow. Intelligence is really logical thinking. If that were true, then computers are already there. It's really being funny or sexy and so or loving that where humans still have an edge. I believe ultimately computers will learn that, but these are extensions of ourselves. It's not an alien invasion from Mars. These are extenders of ourselves. And that's why we've created these tools. We couldn't reach that piece of fruit in a higher branch, so we created a tool that enabled us to reach a higher branch. And we've been creating more and more sophisticated tools to extend our physical reach and now our mental reach and ultimately our emotional reach. And our ability to express emotion in these transcendent ways, like music or poetry, is the ultimate achievement of the neocortex. And other primates, other mammals who have a neocortex are not able to do that. And the enabling factor was the additional neocortex we got with the frontal cortex. So, how about if we add more? That additional quantity will actually enable us to take another qualitative leap and write even more transcendent poetry.
Well, here's kind of a follow-up question to that from a 16-year-old here in the audience named Connor, who figures he's probably the youngest guy here today, but he wants to know, how do you brainstorm all of your brilliant ideas? How do you sit down and bring these theories to fruition?
Well, I'll mention one technique I actually use a lot, and I really find it useful, which is to harness my dreams, literally. Freud said that in your dreams, the sensors, C-E-N-S-O-R-S, are relaxed. We have lots of parts of our neocortex that are constantly telling us you can't think that way. So that's why in a dream, these sensors are relaxed and you might dream about something that's culturally or sexually taboo. You allow yourself to think these thoughts. Well, there are professional taboos also. You can't solve a signal processing problem using these ideas, and linguistics doesn't work that way. Well, those are also relaxed. So I do this every night, pretty much every night. I assign myself a problem. And it could be a real problem with an invention, how to solve a certain piece of technology or a math problem, or it could be a business strategy problem or a relationship problem. This person was mad at me because it was a misunderstanding. What's the best way to deal with that? I pick one problem, and I try to think, what do I know about it? But I try not to solve it because that would cut off the creative thinking about it. Now, something else that doesn't work in your dreams is your rational faculties are not functioning. So that's why when the elephant walks through the wall, the most amazing thing about it is that you don't think it's amazing. It's like, okay, the elephant walked through the wall. You can't really evaluate what's reasonable in your dreams. So in fact, I will assign myself a problem, I'll think about it, and then I fall asleep. And if I wake up in the middle of the night, I usually do at least once, I'll see that I'm dreaming in some strange oblique way about that problem. I try not to interpret it at that point. The next step in the morning, when I try to get into this in-between stage of dreaming and being awake, I'm still kind of in the dream. I have the dream emotion. This doesn't work, by the way, if your alarm clock goes off. But I have an awareness that I'm in a bed, for example. And so now I actually have my rational faculties. I can now take these dream ideas and apply rational faculties to see do they make sense, or maybe how can I interpret them to make sense. Invariably, doing that for 15 or 20 minutes, I gain some key insight and sometimes some very dramatic ideas where I will then spend the next several hours writing up a patent application or a letter to a friend or... I feel actually during the day I'm just carrying out these dream decisions.
So there are biologists and cognitive psychologists who criticize your theory of the model of the brain, of trying to reverse engineer a brain, as being too simple. Wondering if this person from the audience, wondering if you can explain how you answer that criticism, which you actually do in the book when you bring in some of the critics, Paul Allen and others.
Paul Allen wrote a thesis with this idea. There's an article in Technology Review that every single connection, all these little twists and turns of the neural connections, of which there are hundreds of trillions of them, are there for a reason and were fashioned by evolution to do exactly the right job. And so therefore there are thousands of trillions of bytes of design information, because it's all of these connections were designed intentionally, and they're all different. It's like saying, going in a forest and saying every single branch was designed to be there for a purpose. That's not really the right way to understand a forest. And it's not the right way to understand a brain. And if, in fact, there were thousands or trillions of bytes of design information, where the heck is that design information? The design of the brain is in the genome. There's only 25 million bytes of design information in the genome about the brain. I derived that figure in the book, but that's the amount of data in the genome after lossless compression that's applied to the brain. That's many millions of times less than would be necessary if Paul Allen's conjecture about how it's organized is correct. So how do we get hundreds of trillions of connections? Well, through massive redundancy. I mean, there's 300 million of these modules. They're all not identical. They're all very similar. there's a certain way that they're organized, but that each module is not separately defined. I mean, there's one basic definition for how that module works, and then it says, okay, repeat 300 million times. It's more complicated than that, but it's a level of complexity we can understand in our understanding. So that's one answer to that. And we are gaining that insight, and we can see the repetition, and we can see how these modules work. And it's, you have to take hints and insights from many different pieces of neuroscience, from some examples of artificial intelligence. We can see that very similar techniques actually work in AI. There's a technique that I helped pioneer in the 80s and 90s called hierarchical hidden Markov models, which is mathematically very simple, very similar to what I believe happens in the neocortex. And we can then see actually how that technique works in our computers, and that gives us certain insights. So you have to draw upon a lot of different sources. But the picture is actually becoming quite clear, and that's what I articulate in the book.
So here's, let me combine two questions because we're just about out of time here. You can choose to answer one or both. A serious one, which you deal with in the book. Free will, identity, consciousness, are these questions that can be resolved through science? And where do you make your leap of faith where those might be concerned? And then someone from the audience wants to know, are you just a robot sent from the future to prepare us for the assimilation?
Maybe, but but if so, I haven't been told about that mission. I have a chapter, Thought Experiments on the Mind, and the reason this is called How to Create a Mind is a mind is a brain that's conscious, has free will and identity, so it brings in those issues. And I make the case that those are in fact philosophical issues, not scientific issues, and that's not clear on its face. But I really try to demonstrate that there's no falsifiable experiment, which is the essence of science, that you could run that would prove that an entity is or isn't conscious without making some philosophical assumptions. Another way to put it is you can't build a machine and you slide an entity in and a green light goes on. Okay, this one's conscious. No, this one isn't. Without building in some philosophical assumptions. So different philosophers would build in different assumptions. John Searle would want to test whether or not it's squirting biological neurotransmitters. And if it isn't, the green light won't come on. And Dan Dennett would be substrate independent, but he would want the entity to have a model of its own thinking. And then maybe it would be conscious if it could actually describe its own thinking processes. And, but these are all leaps of faith. Sometimes there are theories put forth, like the Penrose-Hameroff thesis, that there's quantum computing going on in the tubules of the neurons, and that's responsible for consciousness. So if you read that paper, it looks a lot like a scientific paper. It's got lots of scientific information about the tubules and analysis of how that could, in theory, support quantum computing, and it goes on and on. There's a lot of mathematical equations, and then there's a sentence that says, we think this is the basis of consciousness. And I'm thinking, whoa, Nelly, this is a leap of faith, not a lot different than any other leap of faith. Like there's a supreme being that bestows consciousness on certain entities. And but then I go on to actually make the case that we need a leap of faith. Some scientists then say, yes, that's true, that consciousness, and similarly for free will, it's not a scientific issue, and therefore it's an illusion, and we shouldn't waste time on it. The only problem with that approach is that our whole moral system is based on consciousness. So if I cause pain and suffering to a conscious entity, that's immoral, unless there's some very good reason for it, and that would also have to do with consciousness, because maybe I'm protecting 100 other conscious entities, but it all has to do with our effect on the conscious world. If I destroy my property, that's probably okay. If I destroy your property, it's probably not okay, but not because I'm causing pain and suffering to the property, but to you, the owner of the property. And in fact, inanimate objects are only important insofar as they affect the conscious experience of conscious entities. Conscious experience is the foundation of our moral system. And loosely, our legal system is based on our moral system. So I wouldn't be so quick to dispense with the notion. And I maintain that you actually need a leap of faith to get up in the morning as to who and what is conscious. And you might think we probably all have the same leap of faith, but actually there are differences, and there's underlying disagreements that people have on, for example, animal rights. If you really believe, as I do, that higher level animals are conscious, then you have one attitude, that these are really kind of like people. Some people think that no, animals operate by instinct and it's kind of a primitive machine-like response and there's nobody home. I think it underlies certain aspects of the abortion debate. When does the fetus become a conscious person? So without examining those issues in any further depth, we need actually a leap of faith, and I articulate in the book what my leap of faith is, which is really based on the Turing test, a valid Turing test. And without getting into the details of the test, if an entity that's non-biological is really convincing that its emotions are real because it has the subtle cues that we associate with being angry or loving and so on, I will believe that they are real and that it is having those subjective experiences. And people say, well, but it probably will have some differences that will give it away. Well, that betrays the assumption that then it's not convincing. So if it's really fully convincing, then I will be convinced by it. And I believe the humanity will as well. And our reaction to fictional characters like R2-D2 and all these fictional machines that in fact display convincing emotions, and we feel for them, just like people. So there's similar dilemmas on free will. There's some interesting experiments I talk about in the book where for many of our decisions, we actually start to carry out the decisions and we're beginning to actually move on them before we're even aware that there was a decision to be made. And we do know that most of what goes on in the neocortex is not conscious. And is that part of our free will? Are we really responsible for things that we're not conscious of? It's probably a bad defense to say, yeah, well, I did kill the person, but I wasn't paying attention. So I talk about some of the dilemmas. And identity is also a big dilemma. And I come out with, if there's a continuity of pattern, even though I start introducing non-biological parts into my brain, and some people have already done that, if there's a continuity, then it's the same person. Because actually we're changing our physical constitution anyway. I'm completely different stuff than I was 6 months ago. And I make the analogy to a river. The Charles River goes outside my office, and you could ask, is that the same river that it was yesterday? The water is completely different. There's an old Chinese saying you can't walk in the same river twice. But people still call it the same river. The pattern actually has not changed. Now, the pattern does change slowly, maybe over years, as gradual changes in the pattern. But there's a continuity of pattern. So it's the same river. We are the same person because the pattern has continuity, even though the stuff is just like the water that flows through a river.
Well, thank you very much, Ray Kurzweil. I hope you've enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Ray Kurzweil, author of How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating more than 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.